Chat with Traders, episode 59.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
Episode 59 of the Chat with Traders podcast is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Speed, reliability, and accessibility. Three pillars that support the world-class TT platform from Trading Technologies, which is used by trading professionals around the globe. Go to trade.tt now to learn more and sign up for a free account to experience a renowned futures platform today. You'll get full access to the tools that make Trading Technologies a tech leader within our industry. Again, try the TT platform free today at trade.tt. Hey guys, welcome to another episode. I have an awesome guest for you this week on the podcast. My guest is Daniel Goldberg, and he's a partner at Futex. Futex is a proprietary trading firm located in the UK. Dan has been involved with financial markets since 1995, straight out of college, and got his start as a bookrunner on the exchange floor. He later became a pit trader and was also there for the transition to electronic markets. These days, Dan plays a major role in training new traders to the firm and continues to actively trade, predominantly focusing on two markets, bunds and euro stocks. Some of the topics we hit on during our discussion were how Dan seeks out trading opportunities and uses tools such as the price ladder and market profile, and how macro events have a significant impact on his trade decisions. I also asked Dan a bunch of questions about prop trading, and he has some really interesting points to share on the topic of risk. So there's plenty to learn, plenty to take in. Let's get right to it. You're listening to the Chat with Traders podcast. Please welcome my guest from London, UK, Daniel Goldberg. Dan, welcome to the podcast, man. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Good. Pleased to do this.
All right. Well, thanks a million for coming on, Dan. I've really been looking forward to this. And you were, of course, highly recommended as a must interview by Tom Dante. Guys listening, he was on episode 39 and awesome interview. So make sure you check that out after this one, of course. So, Dan, the way I see this discussion headed, we'll talk about your earlier years because you've been doing this for just over 20 years now. We'll also talk about the opportunities you seek out in your trading these days. And I have a bunch of questions I want to ask you about prop trading. So how's that? Sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. So, Dan, take us back to 1995. What was your intro to trading and what was it about financial markets that appealed to you?
I think the first thing to understand is I was pretty raw and pretty naive, sort of thinking back to, I guess most 18-year-olds are, but I didn't have the entry into the financial world that I guess a lot of people do now. I mean, when we interview people now, we expect them to know what a financial future is, and honest to God, I had no clue. I guess I fell victim to a couple of films that were out around that time. So, I mean, these are films that I ask people if they've watched nowadays and they've never heard of them. But you think back to like Trading Places or Wall Street. Although they're maybe slightly different to where I ended up, that was my early influence. The news media tended to still cover the trading floor and the pits and all the shouting and screaming, and that just got my early addiction going. I've got to be honest, I had absolutely no idea what I was heading into. I just remember thinking at the time that it was a pretty good idea to finish off my college, not worry too much about university and head into the big wide world, and just literally I sent hundreds of CVs to any address I could find. We had to use post back then, and I just scoured the city with my CV and with letters trying to get in. And it took a while. I had a few interviews that didn't pan out, but the one interview that I did eventually end up getting, I had actually on the life floor. And I think the moment I stepped on the live floor, I just thought, yeah, this is for me. This is the place I want to be. So that's really how I sort of stumbled across it. I think really and truthfully, for the first 3 years of my running stroke trading career, I probably didn't still know what a Bund future was, but that's where I was.
Okay, sure. So while you were in college, you know, while this fascination for markets started to grow, were you doing any trading just on your own at that stage?
No, it was so different back then. I mean, you've got to remember half of this. I know it makes me sound like such an old bastard, but I didn't even have the internet back then. I mean, we were 18 and I didn't even have a mobile phone. So the access to it was not the same as it is now. It seems like, you know, you can sit on a train and whomever you're sat next to will have an IG account or some other such spread betting firm's account. And it wasn't like that back then. You couldn't access it in the same way, or at least I didn't know how to access it in the same way. And I had no, you know, parental backing. I mean, I was living day to day. I had no financial support whatsoever. So I wouldn't have even had 50 or 100 quid to shove in a spread betting account.
Of course, yeah. No, that makes sense now that you actually mentioned it. I didn't even put two and two together.
So, yeah, I know, showing my age early in the interview. Yeah.
No, it's good. It's good. So how did you first get your foot in the door? Like you said, you were putting CVs out to, you know, hundreds of banks and, you know, trying to get interviews here, there and everywhere. How did you first get your foot in the door?
Pure luck. I mean, it really was. Unfortunately, I think what a lot of people don't realise is the fine lines and the sort of the fortunate margins that life throws at you. And I know that to a certain degree you do make your own luck, and I was throwing myself out there and speaking to everyone, but eventually it came through a family member. It just so happened that some obscure relation, I think it was my grandma's sister's daughter, so I don't know what that makes her to me, happened to be a teacher, and she taught the two gentlemen that ended up being traders on the live floor. And I was making quite a lot of noise, saying that I wanted to get into the industry. And it happened to just, in conversation, fall down through the ranks of the family. And it turned out that it ended up getting mentioned to them. So they said, come along and have a chat. I don't think they even saw a CV. I remember one of the brothers who... I spoke to one of the brothers, but he was busy trading. And the other one I ended up playing crib with. And at the time, I didn't know that really it was kind of a test of my sort of mental speed that we were playing this card game. But I was fortunate enough to know the game and actually be reasonably good at it. So that genuinely, no word of a lie, is how I ended up getting my first job as a runner on the live floor.
Right, okay. So what is the actual role and position of a book runner? Like, what does that entail?
Well, when you think back now, you know, you click a button and your order is in there, and then it drops into your fill window, and then magically it ends up on your statement the next day. But back when we first started, all of these exchanges were done by hand. So the trader in the pit would be shouting and trading and, you know, doing his trades with other counterparties, and he would be handwriting them. He would be putting them on a piece of card, and, you know, throughout the course of the day, he would be sort of totting up his position and, you know, most often his P&L as well. But it was my job to go and collect those cards off him. Depending on who the trader was and how often they traded, you had to kind of decide, and how busy the market was, you had to decide how often you wanted to jump in and get the cards. But then you had to go, you know, write them in a book, make sure the trader was correct in his position and his P&L. And then you had to type them into an old, I think it was called a TRS system. And once you typed them into that system, that's when they went off to the back office and then got manually allocated to trader's account, you know, for the next day. So it was a fairly lengthy process, which is why it makes me laugh nowadays when traders, you know, they bitch and moan and scream and cry if their system maybe freezes for a millisecond. You know, quite frankly, back in the proper trading days, a trader wouldn't know his P&L. He might not have time to work it out. And there were a lot of times when a trader would have accidentally, you know, added up his position wrong or read a plus as a minus. I mean, I've had it where, you know, certainly one of my bigger traders, you know, he was a couple of hundred lots the complete wrong way. He thought he was long 200 and I made him short 200. And at 18, I had to have the confidence and surety that I'd got it right to go and tell him that actually he's 400 lots round the wrong way.
Wow, okay. So you told us a little bit about how you met these two guys. Can you tell us a little bit about about the background of these two guys? I know they're now your partners at Futex there, but what was their trading experience at this point in time?
They'd done, you know, a little bit more, certainly, than I had. One of them was working at the Bank of England and sort of got introduced to what financial futures was, you know, via that background. I'm not, you know, to be honest, I'm not actually too sure what his role was there. And I think he'd also been at NatWest. And I know one of the other guys was trading, I think it was Japanese warrants at the time. So they did have more of a trading background and had a little bit more of an understanding of the industry. And I think when they eventually went onto the life floor, they were kind of mid-20s. But both of them had to give up what at that time was, you know, a reasonably well-paying job and sort of take the gamble of being a self-backed local, you know, with no sort of impending salary.
Yeah, no doubt. So from being a book runner, you then began actually trading on the floor. Tell us, how did this work out for you?
Oh, it wasn't good. I mean, I, as confident and as sure of myself as I thought I was, I think when you get put in that environment, it really does humble you. I mean, look, at a stretch, I'm 5'9", and, you know, I'm still leaner now. And when I was sort of 18, 19, I was probably classed as skinny. And you're shoved in this pit, and you don't know what really you're doing. You're trying to decide whether the market's going up and down. No profile, no footprint, no charts, no, you know, indication or tricks or patterns on the ladder. You were with other human beings. And these guys were experts at what they were doing. The most of them were, you know, had 10 plus years on me. And they were all, you know, to an individual, all very boisterous, all very aggressive. I guess, you know, if people want a comparison, they're kind of your sort of, I don't know, highly aggressive market stall type owner. So it was intimidating. It was really intimidating. And I had nothing, the intellect really didn't matter. And I think that, you know, these weren't by any stretch of the imagination stupid people, but it wasn't the most important thing down there. And I'd always throughout my whole sort of life up until then, be it through, you know, private school or college or whatever, I'd literally always relied on my intellect. And all of a sudden, it was of very little use. And so, yeah, those early years on the life floor, I mean, I was not a successful pit trader. And I think had it have carried on, I don't think I ever would have been a successful pit trader. I don't think the way things were then, if they'd have carried on, I was a bit too late to the party, and there wasn't the same sort of time and resource to be able to learn these things. So, you know, I mean, kudos to anyone who did make a substantial living down there. I mean, that is some talent to do that.
Okay, so you said at the beginning of your answer there that, you know, you obviously had no charts, you had no indicators, no market profile. What were you basing your decisions to buy and sell on?
Oh, a gut feeling. I mean, honestly, it was just whether you thought it was going up or not, whether the noise was, you know, a little bit louder in one direction. I mean, I think back to it now, you know, I can't possibly imagine what I was making my decisions on. I mean, there was one time, I remember it quite vividly, and I remember the trader that did it to me, and I've met him since, and he probably doesn't remember it at all, but he was broking for Merrill's at the time. And I ended up being short buns into an interest rate hike. Now, I didn't even know that there was an announcement. I mean, I didn't know what interest rates meant to financial futures. I didn't know what any of these figures meant to financial futures. I mean, that's how green I was. But by pure luck, I ended up being short into a rate hike. And as the market started coming off, I actually covered my position with this trader for 3 ticks. I mean, this was into an unexpected rate hike where I'd managed to sort of luckily find myself short. And I don't know why I did it, but I remember I hit this trader to get out of my position and take 3 ticks. And as you can imagine, it was 50 or 60 ticks lower. And I went back to kind of check the trade with him. And he was a little bit unsure as to whether I'd done it or not. He was, you know, he knew he'd done something with someone, but until I'd gone over to check the trade with him, he wasn't sure who it was. And I'll never forget that, just the utter humiliation that this guy subjected me to, you know, in front of the whole pit, of being the utter arsehole who, you know, A, didn't quite know whether he had even done the trade anyway, and B, if he had done the trade, was, you know, such an appalling trader that, you know, he'd covered a rate hike for a 3-tick profit. And, you know, I think when I think back to these sort of things, I think it's that sort of humiliation and that sort of character, I guess at that point it was character assassination. It's those sort of things that actually made traders what they were and actually made them what they could become. And I do think that's what we're lacking now. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The life floor would not exist because of all of the new rules that we have and the new, you know, health and safety rules, the new, you know, rules in terms of, you know, what's acceptable. That floor just wouldn't exist. I mean, there would literally be someone getting sued every day. But unfortunately, it's made people softer. And I don't think that goes hand in hand with trading. I don't think being soft is the right thing to make a trader. And that's probably what is lacking and why people find it very hard to this day to come through. That sort of brutality that certainly I was subjected to definitely fueled fires.
Okay. Now that's really interesting, Dan. So let's talk about how things started to turn around for you. I think it was around 2000 with the introduction of electronic markets. Tell us about how that affected you.
Well, that was the big turning point for me, because all of a sudden I gained an edge. Because it wasn't about physicality, it wasn't about aggression, it wasn't about who you knew, it wasn't about where you stood in the pit and whose broker you had in your pocket. All of a sudden, it put people on a little bit more of a level playing field, and you could participate. I mean, what people don't understand is, if I actually did get a trade right, or was near getting a trade right, and I went to trade with someone, a broker could turn around and say no. They could literally turn around to you and go, fuck off, I don't want to trade a one lot with you, because I literally can't be asked working a 99 lot as opposed to a 100 lot. And they could do that, and brokers very frequently did. They would sit there and they would say, you take the lot or you take nothing. And of course I was restricted by you know, the size that I could trade. But electronic trading changed that. It meant that you could actually participate and you could at least get in and you could at least get out where you wanted to. And it gave me the chance to be on my own, be in a room, and start to understand what was happening with the market. And people spoke more. And that's really where you got the first real bit of tutoring into, you know, what you should be looking for and what you should be doing and how you should be approaching it. And the evolution and the move from the live floor to Eurex as well created a lot of opportunities. And really the first opportunity for me was I was doing okay on what they were called the old DTB screens. They were black and white, no price ladder, no depth, just literally a bid and an offer. But I was doing okay. But then the Lifebund went completely onto what the older system, which was called APT. And that was the automated pit trading system that Life had. And it went 24 hours on, the Lifebund went 24 hours onto this, but at the same time you had the German Bund, and they didn't always trade within a tick of each other because the automated programs, the algorithms hadn't quite got there yet. So it literally became a system where if you were quick enough and smart enough, you could trade with your left hand Life APT Bunds and with your right hand Eurex DTB Bunds. And, you know, they did get, very, you know, at one point, I remember they were nearly a point wide. And you could adjust. It was the purest arbitrage that there was at the time. And, you know, in terms of free money, I think it's one of the last sets of free money that the markets have ever given out. And I was fortunate enough that I was very quick onto the sort of electronic transformation. And whereas other people were sort of still trying to get to grips with it, a lot of pit traders were losing money coming out of the pits onto the electronic screens because it was so different. That was really where I took off. And then from there, kind of, you could invent your own spreads. I mean, there was a time when the Bund and the BTPs moved in the same direction. So that was a spread that I did and again was fortunate enough to be successful in. And, you know, that lasted until, I don't know, 2002, 2003, where you could pick off these spreads that had a natural relationship and that were still around. I mean, there was such a thing. It's the oats now, but it used to be called the Notionnel. And again, these things all moved in tandem. It wasn't like it is now where, you know, you'll get these moves and one day the Bund will go up and the oats will go down because people are worried about contagion or worried about the difference between France's GDP to Germany. It was a much less complicated time. People just accepted that, you know, the Bund would go in the same direction as the BTP or the Notionnel. And there was a lot of money to be made to trading those spreads. And it, you know, really gave me the chance. By the time I got to 2003, 2004, it just gave me the financial stability and chance to be able to trade outrights, which is what I've carried on doing to this day.
Right. Okay, so let's step forward to current times now. How do you trade nowadays and what opportunities are you looking for?
I think you constantly evolve how you're trading. It's not, you've got to be aware that the market changes, you know, week by week. You know, the first 2 weeks of January were great and the second 2 weeks were appalling. And I think that I approach the markets looking at certain things, at certain indicators. I always work from, you know, the big picture down. I think that's something that has always stuck with me. I try not to get too bogged down in the very small intricacies that I think a lot of traders make the mistake of getting bogged down in. So, you know, we all know that there are algorithms in there to sort of shake you out for three or four ticks. We all know they're there, so kind of stop having three or four tick stops and getting stuck in the middle. But you've got to work from the big picture down always and get your bias right. And, you know, then you work it backwards. And there's lots, you know, there's lots of techniques, but the ones that I find work for me, you know, are the real very basics that are quite easy to sort of teach anyone. So, you know, you've got to start with your support resistance and your trend lines. You've then got to work through the other things that, you know, off your bar chart you would know work, such as gaps, head and shoulders. And then you really sort of, as you sort of work down, you've got to start looking at your volume and your volume profiling. And I think that, for me, is one of the biggest keys and indicators as to what the market's attempting to do and where participants are actually looking to build positions. And it doesn't just mean looking for high volume or low volume. It means looking for, you know, actually what's the activity that's going through. Are there genuine buyers or sellers here? Or are we looking at an algorithm that's just purely churning 5,000 lots because it can? And, you know, there are lots of techniques within that you can use. So, you know, within your profile, you're looking at, you know, things like your points of control, your volume points of control, you know, the volume weighted average price, your VWAP as it's called, gives you an incredible indication as to, you know, where other participants are positioned and where they're caught. So you're always looking for things like that. But for me, that's almost as far as it goes. You know, a very cursory look at perhaps what a Bollinger or a moving average may be doing, but that's incredibly supplementary, you know, as an additional tool, not something that I would blindly trade off. And I honestly don't subscribe to any of the fancier tools or any of the, you know, other studies that may or may not be there. I think that's enough to keep an eye on. If you're trading two markets, you know, that's a lot to take in. And one of the hardest things as a trader is to kind of not miss these things and to keep an eye on everything. And that can be quite draining, which is, you know, we'll come to it later. It's one of, for me, one of the key advantages of trading in a prop firm is that you've got more eyes on it, and you certainly will miss things yourself. But there will always be someone else that will, you know, if you build a good team atmosphere, will shout it out to you and give you a heads up. I mean, there was a good example. I missed a flag in the Eurostoxx yesterday. Really quite obvious now, but I was clearly tired. I was getting a little bit obsessed with the Bund yesterday, as people might know who follow me on Twitter. And I completely missed that there was this flag building in the Eurostoxx, and you know, it got shouted out by one of the lads, and I had a glance, and I saw that he was right, and then you make the decision to sort of trade it yourself after that. So that's really sort of how I approach things.
Excellent. Yeah, I definitely do have a lot of questions around that type of thing, you know, the prop trade environment. I want to dig into this a little deeper. So, but just before we do, just quickly, what markets are you predominantly focused on today, in current times, and do you strictly trade intraday, or are you sometimes carrying positions over a longer time frame?
At the minute, Bunds and stocks are taking up most of my time. I think you have to watch the S&P, and you certainly have to watch the 10-year if you're trading either of those two products. Yesterday it was very clear that there was something going on in the 10-year, and it is going to have an effect on the Bund. So you can't be blind to what's going on around you. You know, likewise, you knew that the FTSE was getting hammered yesterday and was going to actually probably cause a drain on everything else. So you've got to be aware of all of the correlated markets that there are, but predominantly Bund and Eurostoxx is where I'm more comfortable putting my trades. I think the S&P is a great market, but I do think that you need a lot of size to trade the S&P, probably size that once I would have been comfortable with, but as I get older, I think your risk parameters change, and what you can lose changes. So I think that's a market that you do need a lot of size to trade. So for me, bunds and stocks is where I sit. I keep an eye on everything. I think everything is correlated. Whatever position you're putting on today, you're trading the oil. You know, let's be honest, if you're, you know, if you're buying euro stocks today, it's only going up if oil rallies. You know, that's how it is at the moment. Things come in fashion and out of fashion, and you've got to be very, very aware and fluid as to what you're looking at. So that's where I sit at the moment, bunds and stocks primarily.
Okay, so Dan, if you could speak to us about the importance of the price ladder for your trading approach, and maybe just take it back a step. What actually is a price ladder, and what type of information or insight does it provide you with?
The price ladder's it's basically your market depth, and it's how I would say 95% of the industry, you know, trades with whatever their market is. And watching your price ladder and watching your price action should and will eventually either give you the confirmation that your ideas are correct, or it will give you the confirmation that you should stand out of the way. So you've got your market in the middle, you've got your prices down the middle of the price ladder. So at the minute, for example, the Euro stocks is trading 29.30-31, and if through the middle of that price ladder you'll have prices going 20 ticks higher and 20 ticks lower that maybe you can visually see, and you'll have a depth of market that sits either side of that. So you'll be able to see, if the market's 29 bid at 30, you'll be able to see what orders are sort of running down the ladder to, you know, 19, and what orders are running up the ladder to about 40. And it's an amalgamation of orders, and it's constantly changing because obviously there's so many spread algorithms or just natural algorithms that price ladder is always moving, and the bids and offers are always changing. But it's really the significance of what you can see going through at the price that you want to trade. So you will have your predetermined plan. You will, for example, I don't know, if the Euro stocks runs down to 80 today, you might be thinking, okay, I want to buy 28.80s. But as it gets there, you'll start monitoring the price action. You'll start monitoring what's happening. Are the sellers more aggressive? Are the sellers in control? Are people pulling their bids off of the ladder because they're too nervous? When it gets to your price, is someone reloading the bid? So, for example, he might start with a 200 lot, and as he gets hit on 50, he might reload it and put another 50 on, and another 50. And there's all these techniques, and they take hours to learn. And, you know, really and truthfully, before, you know, up until very recently, you could only learn these things actually on a live price ladder. Even the simulators, you can't quite see what's going on as well as you can on a live price environment. So it really is that last piece of the puzzle, that last sort of checklist that tells you whether you want to be interacting. And there's lots of tricks and there's lots of games that people play on the ladder. Some of them legal, some of them in a grey area, some of them not legal at all, but they do still get played. And these are all sort of short-term price increments that you can take advantage of. You know, someone might move the price up by 4 or 5 ticks without it trading, and you know, then pull the bids thereafter. And you know, you can really, as a day trader, you can really take a lot of these smaller price increments out of the market, as opposed to using that price ladder for your really sort of major confirmation bias as you get near areas that you want to trade. And we focus a lot on that you know, as a company here, you know, all of our grads that come through, the importance of just watching that price ladder and understanding that price ladder, you know, can be the difference between someone who makes a great living as a trader and someone who doesn't quite make it as a trader. There's obviously lots of other things that go into it. You know, obviously there will be, but, you know, that actually will be one of them. And we focus, there's a lot of attention that we pay to that. And I don't want to head down the route of major sales, but, you know, some of the things that we're inventing and creating are primarily based around the price ladder to help people understand what they should and shouldn't be seeing and accelerate the learning, because, you know, the learning curve for trading is very, very long and very, very arduous, and lots of people haven't got the finances to actually sort of stay the course and learn how to trade. So we're always looking at ways to kind of accelerate their learning and sort of help push them on their way to a, you know, a successful career.
Yeah, I mean, I did notice it was very prominent on your site, the price ladder, that is. So, I mean, that's sort of why I wanted to ask you about it. And just a quick one, just so we're clear, does the price ladder differ from level two in any way?
Oh, good question. I mean, I look, I'm so used to price ladders, I'd have to be shown a level two. As far as I understand, level two is your market depth, but I'm not sure how that gets displayed on every other system. Our guys work off of two systems. They work off of TT and Neon. So it would really, I guess, level two is that type of data, but I've got no idea how that would be displayed on various other platforms.
All right, that's cool. I was just trying to avoid any of the listeners getting caught up on terminology differences, but that's cool. So in addition to the price ladder, how does the market profile and footprint influence your trading ideas?
Market profile, it very, very much gives, I think it gives me, you know, a major, major edge. That people need to understand that no matter what they're looking at, these markets may appear random, but they're not. And I think people really do need to understand that. There will be short-term price movements that, you know, might seem random, but they're not. And what the essence of a market is that it's just trying to find value. That's all it's doing. And the key difference with these markets is the level of uncertainty. So if you think of a short-term interest rate, we pretty much know what value is. You know, we can base that on the fact that something is really unlikely to happen in the next 2 months, and interest rates are such that that is value. And if you think in terms of whenever you go to a shop, we all kind of know what perceived value is. You know, a Mars bar used to be 30 pence, but now perceived value is 70 pence. And all markets are trying to do is find value. That is the basis of a market. And sometimes it will overshoot value to the downside. Sometimes it will overshoot value to the upside. But that is what it's looking to do. It's trying to find balance. And then once it's found balance, it will trade around balance, and then it will either shift or remain the same. You know, that's in essence what a market is attempting to do. So if you think in terms of what a market profile is giving you and it's telling you where the market perceives value at any given time, where the majority of volume is going through, and that's where the greater portion of people accept that value is. And then it's telling you when it's shifting. And yesterday, for a short time, perceived value in the Eurostox, for example, was 30.08. And we traded there quite nicely. We did a fair chunk of volume. And we didn't really move for about an hour, more than two or three ticks outside of that. But then there was a shift. And the market moved, and the market started selling off. And then throughout the day, we were assessing where is value, where today does this market perceive value. And at some times it was 29.72, at some times it was, you know, much lower. At the end of the day, our volume point of control where the market perceived value to be is 29.43. And we closed below that, but that is where the market perceived its value to be. And the context of what a profile gives you is where those value areas are, where the volume has been done, and where the market's attempting to seek balance. And if you can kind of get the idea that this is just one big auction, and this is one big auction where it can overshoot and undershoot based on participants' emotions and, you know, fear or comfort, then you can start to understand the way in which the market flows and the way in which the market ebbs and flows. And that's the key to what market profile does. You know, anything within a candlestick chart or anything within a bar chart, it's giving you the price data, it's telling you the highs and lows and closes, and it's giving you a pattern, but it's not giving you value. It's not telling you where people are accepting a value area to be. And I think that's really, for me, you know, the market profile or volume profiling, it's taking into account, you know, time and volume and price. It's taking in those three things. You know, a candlestick chart, it's not necessarily giving you all of that information. It's giving you the highs and lows, and it's giving you a time bias, but it's not giving you the volume and the value. You know, you could have a bar that goes, is a 50 tick bar, but what does that really mean? A 50 tick bar from, you know, high to low to back into the middle, it doesn't give you enough of the story as to that could be done on 2-1 lots.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I think you summed that up really well. That was a really good explanation, Dan. Thank you. Now, I've kind of gone about this back to front. I know you said you sort of come to the market from a top-down approach. I've kind of asked you these questions in reverse. But besides the price action and, you know, the things we've talked about with the price ladder, the market profile, etc., you said earlier on that you take into account the big picture. So explain to us or just give us a little insight into what kind of macro events and fundamentals have an impact on how you trade.
Yeah, I think you have to be a rounded trader. You have to know everything that's going on, because if you sit here and, you know, in the times that we're in now, if you sit here and you're unaware that oil's collapsing and that it's come down from wherever we were, 100 plus bucks down to 30 bucks, and you're still sat here buying equities, then, you know, you're a fool. And you have to absolutely know what's going on around you from, you know, a macro and a fundamental point of view. And it's so key and it's so important. And some of our, you know, when we do prep our grads, and, you know, some of it we televise, some of it we don't, but, you know, when we prep our guys, the fundamentals will always override technicals, in my opinion, in the short term, because the market will overshoot and undershoot based on the significance of the event that is happening. And you can't tell me that, you know, in today's day and age, unfortunately, with all of the fear and terrorism that's going on, that you're going to sit here and sell bunds because you've got a 5-minute trend line over another, you know, disastrous attack. You know, you'd be an idiot. But above and beyond that, you know, you're knowing what the ECB are doing, what the Fed is doing, what the Bank of England is doing, it's absolutely paramount. You know, the moves do stem from that. At the moment, we are categorically, absolutely across the curve, pricing in negative interest rates. And you have to understand that, because otherwise the Bund looks like the greatest sell in the world at the moment. You know, you're sat here and you're thinking, oh, it's gone up, it's got this, and, you know, this is where I got sucked in yesterday. I actually did go short Bunds. I don't ever advocate that. I'm a perma Bund bull. But, you know, you can't what we're doing is we're pricing in a very, very fundamental and macro situation where people are now expecting, in light of what Japan did, people are expecting negative interest rates. I mean, I can't quite believe it, but they're pricing in negative interest rates for the UK. It wasn't that long ago that we were talking about rate rises. So you really do have to, you have to be a rounded trader. And I hate it when people try and convince other people that there is this one system or there is this one technique that will is the holy grail and will make you, you know, a multi-millionaire this time next year. It's just not true. It's just not. It's a whole multitude of things from, you know, as you point out, from the macro to the fundamental, all the way down to your, and every step in between, all the way down to your price ladder confirmation or your footprint confirmation. I mean, that's just the fact. Every trader I know is, and every successful trader I know is a very, very rounded out person. And some of our ECB discussions border on policy making. You know, I'm sometimes I sit there and I think we're getting so in depth as to what they could and couldn't and should and shouldn't do that, you know, they might as well put us in charge. But, you know, that's just what it takes. It's there's no one single silver bullet. It takes everything, an understanding of everything.
Yeah, yeah, brilliant answer. I'm glad I did ask that question. Okay, well, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor for this week's episode of the podcast, and our sponsor is Trading Technologies. When it comes to platforms, TT from Trading Technologies is the trusted weapon of choice for many industry pros. With unmatched power and speed, futures traders can gain a real tech advantage. Some of the bragging points of the TT platform include the super sexy, clean user interface with fully customizable workspaces. The entire platform is cloud-based, meaning you can access this from virtually anywhere on any device. You'll also have access to a global network of co-located servers for ultra-fast, low-latency trade execution. Included in the platform are advanced tools for spread trading and automated trading. And best yet, transaction-based billing starts as low as just $50 per month. But before you even begin a paying user, go to trade.tt now, learn more, and sign up for a free trial to experience a platform that'll scale above and beyond your trading career. So sign up takes less than 30 seconds, and all you need is an email address. So try TT from Trading Technologies free today at trade.tt. So I'd like to steer this conversation more in the direction of prop trading now. So I'd like to ask you, what are the advantages of trading with a prop firm? And I know it may be a little hard to answer this without some bias, but is there also a downside to prop trading too?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I think for sure prop trading is not for everyone. I think that's a fact. The advantages, if I were to try and sum it up without being too heavily biasing, as you say, which is quite difficult, bearing in mind that I run a prop firm and we've got sort of training courses. But I mean, look, we try and give people the financial backing that they would not normally have to enter into this career. We try and give people the accelerated learning and point them in the right direction. I know that everything is available on the internet, but to sit with people who have been doing this for, in my case, 20 years, you know, my partner's case, 25 plus years, and some of the traders that we've had here are now sort of 10 plus years. To sit with these guys and to be able to be told what works and what doesn't work and what they should be looking for without getting sold anything or being given, you know, misguided influence, parting with their own money, to no avail. To be given all of this, I think, is an incredible advantage. And that's before you even start on the psychological and the mentoring support that, that these guys get. So, for me, there are all of our highly successful traders that are here. They wouldn't be here without us, but likewise, as a firm, we wouldn't be here without them. So it really is a partnership that, that we try and develop and that we try and, you know, bring through. And I think in a retail sector, when you're sat at home, you've only got one pair of eyes on the screen, you're stuck with your thoughts all day that will waver from, you know, this will work or that won't work, or I'm not going to hang on to this trade because I'm scared, or any of these things that you sort of challenge is a challenge for yourself when you're sat at home. I think you can alleviate some of that that pressure when you're in a prop trading environment. Now, the downside is that you're in a group of people that are hitting a higher end of trading. So we're not trading now for $100 a day or £100 a day. We're putting through thousands and thousands of round trips, and we're trading for, you know, if not five figures, six figures. And that's not for everyone, because it takes a certain character, a certain characteristic to be able to take on that type of risk. And there are a lot of people that I'm sure are sat at home, are very good traders, who I do have respect for in terms of their knowledge and what they can impart and how they could maybe mentor, but they're just not cut out to trade in a prop firm because their risk parameters, their personality just doesn't line up with what it takes to be in this type of firm. So, you know, that's, it's not all about the money, it's about the personality and you know what you want from life. It's a much deeper question.
So do you think that the risk side of things is something that can't really be taught or developed? It's sort of almost like something intuitive that you kind of have built in. I don't know if that's a good way of explaining it, but I think you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I, to a large degree, yes, I think it is built in. And I think it's, you can't necessarily teach someone how to take on risk, or how to be comfortable with risk. I mean, the irony is we do have a couple of traders that are probably the most risk-adverse traders I know. And they will only ever be looking for, you know, one or two ticks maximum within the market over quiet periods of time, because they don't have the personality trait that makes them want to take on risk. They have, you know, they have a much different way of going about trading. So it's interesting. It's, you know, these guys have managed to find a way of trading without taking on any risk, but I think they're few and far between. I think they're pretty special traders. I think the biggest overriding problem most people have is being able to put on a trade and then deal with it going offside or coming back at you, or, you know, sitting in a trade and being patient enough and taking on that risk, I would say, is most people's, you know, overriding issue. It's a difficult one. I mean, it's, I've got to be honest, if I had the magic answer as to what created a successful trader, you know, I'd have replicated it, and you know, I'd probably be in charge of a firm, you know, bigger than Goldman Sachs. But it's really hard to pin what specific characteristic makes a good trader. And don't get me wrong, we have tried, you know, we've looked into it, be it psychometric testing, be it, you know, personality profiling. There is no constant, and that's quite hard. It makes it hard when you're taking someone on to know, you know, quite whether they're going to make it as a trader.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the learning process that new traders go through when joining the firm, and how does the whole financial backing work? Like, how is it structured, and what's the process that traders go through to get funding?
Yeah, well, initially, there's kind of two ways in, I guess, to our firm. We have a certain amount of sponsored places that we will allot per intake. So at the moment, we're currently running about 4 intakes a year. And we look to, you know, people apply. We obviously go through their CVs and we bring them in and do a couple of tests. But, you know, the reality is when it comes to the interview, it comes down to trying to get a read of the person and a read of the guy. And it's quite hard because obviously an interview is such a false environment of how a person really behaves. And on top of that, they're behaving without ever having really interacted in the markets these way, you know, in a prop sort of environment way. And it will certainly teach them things about themselves that they didn't necessarily know before. So we offer these sponsored places on each course. The remainder of the places go to people who are willing to sort of self-sponsor themselves, so I pay the fee and come in and train under the same sort of banner as our sponsored guys. And the way we structure it is the first 4 weeks, we really have sort of tailored the first 4 weeks to a lot of classroom theory, and it's a necessary evil, I'm afraid. There's not really anything you can do about it. I think it's probably their least enjoyable time and the trainer's least enjoyable time, because it's a lot of theory, but you have to go through it. It's, you know, like I was saying before, whereas I didn't know what impact non-farm payrolls or a rate rise had on the markets, and that was accepted back then, it's kind of not accepted now. So we have to train our guys, we have to teach them, we have to make them understand. And then we start giving them the techniques that we start to use, and we give them, you know, what we perceive to be the sort of charting armory that they need over that period of time as well. So that's the first 4 weeks. Now the second 4 weeks really is where we start to drill into the price ladder. And what we've invented and what we have is actually probably the thing I'm most proud of at the moment that this company has done. But we have these what are basically price ladder drills. And instead of them just being a normal simulator, we've been recording data for, you know, many, many years, and bringing it onto a platform where actually for the first time that I'm aware of globally, people can interact with. So it's not a simulator, it's not a live market, it's like a replay data of, say, the past 6 or 7 ECB meetings, but traders can actually get involved. Instead of just watching the data, and instead of just watching what may happen in the market, we've given it the ability that traders can interact with that, and they can actually trade it, and they can have a P&L off it. And I mean, to me, this is the key part of the course. This is the gold dust, because up until this price ladder product that we've got, the only way you can get involved in an ECB meeting is to, you know, trade it once every 6 weeks now, and trade it either on a sim or live. And if I'd have been able to go back in my time and had a learning curve where actually I could trade 10 ECB meetings over the course of 4 weeks, or I can practice 10 ECB meetings or 10 non-farm payrolls or whatever the figure is, and practice that over the course of 4 weeks, that would just, you know, would have sent my trading on an absolute stratospheric arc. I mean, it really is just something that those middle 4 weeks, and the price ladder drills are just so key. And to be able to go over and do these things, and it's not just the ECB, it's, you know, it's non-farm payrolls, it's Bank of England, it's whatever rate announcement there may be, and it's also techniques that we've identified. So there's certain bits that specifically tell you how to trade if there's a, you know, flipper in the market, or a layerer in the market, or all of these other things that we know shouldn't maybe happen but do happen. We've got the ability for people to actually interact with these things and actually trade these things. And, you know, that for me, as I've said, accelerating people's learning is really, you know, what we're all about and what we're really attempting to do. And the back 4 weeks is where we start putting them on simulators and actually start monitoring them at their desk and monitoring their progress and monitoring how they actually trade in a simulated but live data environment. And it's then that we start making decisions about whether we can put people live or whether we're willing to, you know, back people. We've had a couple of people who have actually sponsored themselves to come on the course, but have then gone on to want backing, which we have done. So it's not as if, you know, they pay for a course and then we just sort of send them back out into the wide world to fend for themselves. You know, we've got three or four people off our last course, one in the States, that we were so impressed with how he was getting to grips with trading that we've actually backed him to trade from the States remotely. And that takes a hell of a lot of trust, because you're relying on someone to actually behave themselves and adhere to stops and risk management from, you know, where really the only control you've got over it is your first port of call is Skype, you know. The second port call is if they're not responding, you're blocking accounts. Can't go over and talk to them. So, you know, that's really in a nutshell how everything works. You know, we look to back people, we put them on a contract. That gives them our backing, and it gives them our finances and our time. So instead of, you know, only being able to start trading a pound a pip or a one lot, you know, we put people into the market trading bigger than one lot so that they can actually make a living. And obviously in return, there's a, you know, a percentage that would come back across to us that scales up the more money that they make.
Very cool. So after that 12-week program, the initial kind of learning process that they go through, how long do you anticipate before newer traders to the firm actually reach a level of some consistency?
Well, consistency on the sim is very different to consistency live. I think everyone, you know, I know that a couple of the Twitter guys like to call them demo ballers, which is quite an apt name for them. It's one thing taking a fake position and being able to run it offside and then see it back to a scratch and then see it offside and then take it to a profit. And I think gaining consistency on the sim is pretty straightforward. Unfortunately, it's the only benchmark we have. If there were another way to go about it, I would, you know, love to know, and I would drop the sim. But, you know, the majority of people around weeks 20 through to 24, so that's that 5 to 6 month barometer, should be looking to have achieved some form of consistency on the sim. If they haven't, then we need to really start questioning their techniques or their suitability to actually the career. And then that's when we'd look to put them live. And of course, that's when probably the biggest issue that any trader will ever have starts coming into play, and that's their psychology. And that's really where, unfortunately, we do try and help. We do, I'm not a psychologist, but I have got 20 years of experience attempting to help, you know, people through it. We do employ someone who comes in and tries to talk to them. But, you know, it's really where our control starts to get incredibly, incredibly limited. And our ability to influence these guys starts to get less and less, and it starts to become about them and about their psychology and their hunger and their desire and, you know, everything else that comes into, you know, a trader's mindset.
Sure. So just generally speaking, what's the average kind of success rate of the traders that you fund? Because, you know, everyone's heard the statistic that 90 to 95% of traders, you know, retail traders fail, they blow up, they, you know, go out of business. You know, I presume it's more weighted in your favour as a funded trader with a prop firm.
Yeah, it is, and I think that's one of the key advantages. I'm not going to say, it would disrespect the whole interview and make me look like a mug if I said that 100% of the guys that come to us go on to be successful traders. It's just not true. I think the statistics are slightly better and in our favour. I've never worked them out to put a number on it, but you know, the reality is you're still not even looking at 50-50. You know, I couldn't say that half of the guys that come to us end up making money, because it's just not true. What I can say is the ones that do make it make a significant amount of money. They're not just making the equivalent of a £50,000 or £60,000 a year career. They're making, you know, six figures a year and on their way to making seven figures a year. That's really where the key differential is, that the guys that actually are successful in the money that they make is, you know, vastly in excess of what I would imagine the retail sector is doing. But, yeah, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that we knock it out of the park with everyone. The one thing that I would say is that most of the people that do leave us will acknowledge that they've had the best chance that they're ever going to have at being a trader within our firm, and probably 95% of them actually leave and go on to take a more stable and a more career-based job that they're probably suited to. 5%, I know, will go and attempt to trade somewhere else, but within 3 or 4 months, I end up seeing a reference because, you know, it hasn't worked out at the other firm that they've gone to. So, you know, the reality is they go to another firm thinking there might be a holy grail there, but they find out that they're still the same person, they're still the same trader, and the markets are still the same markets. So that's really, you know, all I can say from a prop perspective is I think the people that don't make it have had the best chance that they have had to make it and just realise that trading's not for them and move on. I think our stats are better than 90%, and that those that do make money and are successful make substantial amounts of money and go on to achieve great success, not just, you know, I hate the word mediocrity, but, you know, a lesser degree of success. I think that's probably the fairest and most honest way of answering that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the honesty, Dan. That was a really good answer. So let's just do one last question to take us out. And this is maybe just some, I guess you could call it, parting advice for traders listening. So if someone is feeling completely lost and frustrated as a trader, they're perhaps not sure where to turn, what advice would you give to them?
Step away for a little bit, get some clarity. You need to, if you're really at a point where you're that low, you're not going to make money. You're not going to turn it round by sitting in front of your screen. I honestly think you need to get away. You need to take a mental rain check. Probably need to do something completely unrelated to the markets in any way, shape or form, and not push for an answer. I think the answer will come to you. I think man's thinking, although it's its greatest asset, can also be its greatest enemy, because we can all constantly overthink things that are very, very simple and straightforward. So get away, get some clarity, understand what it is you want to achieve, and if you do want to, you know, come back to trading, then I honestly do believe you should seek professional, trusted advice. There's no holy grail. There's no single answer. It's a myriad of approaches from, as we've discussed, from the macro fundamental all the way down. And I do believe that having a support network is incredibly key. Whether that support network can be, you know, your family to discuss things with, or other people in the industry whom you trust, or a firm. You know, there are those options to sort of seek that advice and help you achieve your dreams. You know, so if you are sort of stuck in the mud and you really, really are suffering, I think, you know, pride comes before a fall. So, you know, reach out to someone and get some help.
Brilliant answer, Dan. I really like that. Well said. So do you want to share with listeners, just before we go here, where they can go to find out more about you and how they can connect with you?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. If people want to get in touch, they can visit either of our websites. There's a lot of information on futexlive.com. You don't need to part with any money. You can get yourself a 7-day trial and you can have a look through there. All of the guys that either stream on the live terminal are trusted, profitable traders, and they share their advice and they share what they're looking at in the market. You'll find me on there 2 or 3 times a week giving my take on the market. And for anyone who does know me or does follow me, you know, my take on the market is not 100% accurate, but it's certainly closer than a lot of other people out there. So have a look around futexlive.com. See if it's for you. See if you like what's there. There's absolutely no commitment required. And then you can get in touch via there. Or have a look around futex.co.uk. That's more of our sort of trade facilitation website. So you can get the gist of what we do there. And, of course, via Twitter. You know, the prop industry is, you know, pretty rife on Twitter, and it's very, very quick and easy to find out who is legit and who knows what they're talking about and who is, you know, not quite as legit and doesn't know what they're talking about. So my any tag, you can just look up Futex Live, and my personal tag is at @DMG_FutexLive, but any of the traders that are set up on there are professional proprietary traders. They're also profitable traders, and people that we kind of link with on there might be in the retail sector or abroad, but there's certainly a wealth of information that other people have got as well. So have a look around. You know, I'm not here to give a hard sell. I'm not a salesman. That's not my thing at all. But I do enjoy helping people achieve their dreams, or at least making them realize that their dreams aren't quite what they think they are.
Very good. Okay, Dan. And guys listening, I'll be sure to include all those links at chatwithtraders.com/59 in case you want to find everything all in one place. Now, Dan, I hope you have a great trading session ahead. I know it's early morning for you. Thank you very much for your time and sharing your insight. Let's stay in touch.
Yeah, pleasure. Happy to do it again whenever you're ready.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.